Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. That was the voice of the man Hollywood called the voice, Frank Sinatra. And this is the voice of the man Hollywood called Troublemaker, John Barber. Welcome to my world. It's 5 o'clock this evening here in Las Vegas, a kind of cool, dreary Las Vegas. And I'm sad to say, one of our famed original strip hotels, the Riviera, is about to go in the same direction as our foreign policy. It is about to be collapsed. And we can only hope it comes down as smoothly and effortlessly as did Building 7 in New York. It is almost 24 hours after the Oscars, America's celebrated supreme salute to bread and circuses and popcorn for the brain. Now, I ran out of Tums, so I didn't have the stomach to watch it for more than a few minutes. But it is astonishing to me that the entertainment capital of the world since its inception has been totally incapable of presenting a truly entertaining award show. It's like that billion-dollar next-generation supersonic jet fighter the government has been pouring our money into for the past 20 years for a plane that hasn't even gotten off the ground yet. And since Bob Hope and Johnny Carson died, they've also been unable to find a classy host. They picked this guy. I say guy because at least he dressed like one. Neil Patrick Harris, and we watch him die. I mean, except for a surprisingly wonderful set from Lady Gaga, of all people, watching the show. And Neo was like watching 6 episodes of The Walking Dead. This Neil Patrick Harris seems to be everywhere now. He's like that lizard in the Geico commercials. They say he's a great actor. Look, I've seen him in his sitcom and in 2 movies. One of them, Gone Girl, in which he makes mad love to Ben Affleck's runaway wife. I'd be happy to call him just a very good actor if just once in one of these scenes he could convince me he was heterosexual. God, that's terrible. Forgive me. Anyway, the best film went to Birdman. For me, Birdman lost the reality of it being a really interesting character study of a desperate actor by introducing the metaphysical nonsense of giving him the ability to fly and float and causing objects to do the same, sort of like a benign carry. Let me tell you, there'll never be a film about the New York theater as good as Joseph Mankiewicz's classic, All About Eve, with Bette Davis. She's ascending the stairs, and she turns to her guests, and she says, "Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night." Well, tonight, fasten your seatbelts, because it's going to be an absolutely wonderfully bumpy night. Have you noticed how Hollywood loves movies about geeks and gimps and retards? Cliff Robertson in Charlie, Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man and Midnight Cowboy, Tom Hanks in Forrest Gump, Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot, and now Redmayne in The Theory of Everything. But the truth is, these are the films that Hollywood seems to do really, really well. I want you to think about this. You know how a pearl is formed? Grains of sand invade an oyster, irritating it to the point it's turned into a pearl. So no matter what kind of background you've had, you can turn your life into a gem. And for me, the gem that came out of that often irritating show last night was that a broader audience was made aware of something they probably never heard of because it vanished from the few theaters it was in almost immediately. And that was Citizen Four. Thankfully, HBO, which funded most of it, will be showing it. And hopefully the millions of you who watched the Oscars might tune in out of curiosity or because it was mentioned in a building filled with famous movie stars. I hope you do so because Citizen Four is one of the scariest movies you will ever see. No one gets killed yet. It's not the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's the CIA, NSA, Obama constitutional massacre. It's a compelling, disturbing, almost heartbreaking behind-the-scenes look at how and why a very appealing 29-year-old Ed Snowden risks everything to inform Americans how the security state under a lying Obama is now spying without cause on every one of us. Most of it takes place in a Hong Kong hotel, which without intent adds to the claustrophobic feeling of being closed in on by the government. To tell us his story, Snowden first sends encrypted emails to Ms. Poitras, the filmmaker, and tell it to the world, she in turn contacts journalist Glenn Greenwald. For nearly 2 riveting hours, we watch and listen behind the scenes as Snowden, all alone, almost like a real Jimmy Stewart character out of a Frank Capra movie, unburdens his soul of his belief in the laws his government is breaking and to protect his fellow Americans whom they are targeting. Aside from discovering how unbelievably likable and supremely intelligent Snowden is, more important, we learn that the government's massive spying has nothing to do with national security. It has to do with advancing and protecting America's corporate and banking interests. It's not a movie that'll make you smile, and most of you who hear me could care less about that. But for those who do care, you can still give thanks that we live in a country that can produce young idealists and filmmakers like Laura Poitras and journalists like Glenn Greenwald and, more important, Americans and activists like Ed Snowden, to whom Obama should forward his mistakenly earned Nobel Peace Prize. So I hope you do watch it. And I also hope, desperately, that this Saturday and Sunday, February 28th and March 1st, at New York's Academy of Medicine, that C-SPAN covers a symposium called The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction, a symposium mounted by and featuring my sole guest tonight. For those of us who remember the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we were told nearly every day we had to take to our shelters, and if we didn't build them, to hide like school kids under our desks, as pointed out by the government's laughable duck and cover. We also remember Stanley Kramer's foreboding film On the Beach, which I'm happy to say will be shown at that symposium. During those tense years, we can all recall the famous philosophers and scientists who spoke out against those bombs: Einstein, Bertrand Russell, Oppenheimer. Those voices are all gone, but the bombs are not. No famous men have taken their place, but there is one amazing woman who is more passionate and more articulate than all of them put together. She started out in Australia as a young pediatrician trying to save children and changed course after Three Mile Island in America and is now trying to save us all. Her worldwide lectures are standing room only. Her latest book, Crisis Without End, The Consequences of Fukushima, is must reading. But most important, She is the most knowledgeable person on the planet speaking out on this subject and is someone we must listen to. Thankfully, we get to listen to her right now. Dr. Helen Caldicott. Ms. Caldicott, thank you so much for being here, and thank you for going to New York with this symposium.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Caldicott, I listened to you twice over the last couple of days on Nuclear Hot Seat, and you were absolutely wonderful. There was kind of a glitch in the sound. Do you hear it?
Just slightly. It's not worrying me at all.
Okay, as long as it's not worrying you. I would, before we get to the nitty-gritty of what it is that you have to say, about 40 years ago, after my success with America's First Reality Show, Real People, I tried to do a humor magazine about real news, in which we would take real news events and show the funny side of the actual human comedy. On the very first pilot that we did a story, Helen, about faulty construction, as reported by the Los Angeles Times, at the nuclear reactor in San Onofre. And we did extensive research on it. We put this two-minute piece together for the show, which the audience loved, which the network would ever air. And I would like to play it briefly for you, since nobody has ever heard it until now. Would you mind?
No, I'd love to hear it.
Okay, here we go.
What Shakespeare said. The world's a stage and we all occasionally fall into the orchestra pit. As you know, politicians are always angry at television. Not because we attack them, but because we quote them.
Well, right now we may upset a few people who are more powerful in our lives than politicians. Clerks and bureaucrats. Because we're going to hear some actual quotes of some of them when they were asked about some semi-sloppy construction at a nuclear reactor.
It recently came to our attention that a nuclear reactor head had been installed backwards at San Onofre, California. So we called to inquire about how it happened, and someone in the public relations office said,
"You better call Cal Edison. They do that kind of work."
When we called Cal Edison, a spokesman said,
"It was installed backwards, but it really wasn't a mistake."
It wasn't?
No, it's what we call a malformance.
We asked them if they also called it a malformance when it was discovered that a reactor in Virginia had been built over an earthquake fault.
Japanese do that all the time.
We asked Cal Edison how they reacted when they did discover it had been installed backwards.
We laughed. Those things happen. We didn't do the actual installation, though. The Bechtel Corporation did that.
Now, the Bechtel Corporation in San Francisco was sued for over $300 million by the state of Michigan for faulty construction of a reactor built there. Bechtel settled out of court for $14 million. When we asked them about the one in San Onofre, an information officer said,
"By some oversight, the reactor head was installed wrong. The arrow that was supposed to point south on the head was pointing north."
Is that dangerous?
No.
It's not?
No.
Why?
Because the pipes which were supposed to be installed on the north are now attached to the head on the south.
And?
Vice versa. What was installed wrong was made right by installing the other things that way.
Are you sure it's safe?
Absolutely.
Then we asked Bechtel if they were the company that contracted to build that nuclear reactor in the Philippines next to an active volcano. And they said,
"No, we just built a hotel."
Helen, is that funny or is that scary?
Oh, it's scary as hell. Absolutely. And it's spot on. It's actually what happened and what they said. That's the mentality epitomized, I think, in the nuclear power industry. And also, to a degree, in the nuclear weapons industry, and both of these industries threaten our very future.
Was Fukushima, as mentioned in that little piece, was it built near an earthquake fault?
Oh, absolutely. Japan is riven by earthquake faults. It's the most sort of actively volcanic island in the world. And, you know, they've built 54 nuclear reactors there. I knew the three GE engineers who designed those reactors at Fukushima, the Mark 1 GE reactors, and their names were Dale Breidenbach, Dick Hubbard, and Greg Miner. They resigned from GE in 1978 because they knew these reactors were very dangerous. They testified before Congress, but it made little difference, and the reactors went ahead and were built near a very major earthquake vault, which brought their demise 3 years ago.
When you were researching your book about Fukushima, what was the most startling thing you discovered?
Well, I didn't research it. I held a conference at the New York Academy of Medicine a year ago on the second anniversary of the Fukushima catastrophe, titled The Medical and Ecological Consequences of Fukushima. And to that conference, I invited some of the nation's and world's leading experts, oceanographers, evolutionary biologists, physicians, engineers, physicists, and the like. So the book Crisis Without End is a compilation of the proceedings from that particular symposium. The symposium that will take place this coming weekend in New York at the Academy of Medicine, titled The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction, those proceedings will also be published in a book by the New Press. So if you want to follow what's going on, both in the nuclear industry in terms of Fukushima or in the nuclear weapons industry dash Russia dash the Ukraine dash the US, you can listen online, actually, live stream, to this symposium by going to the Helen Caldicott Foundation.org, and you can listen to it. But those in New York should definitely, absolutely take advantage of it and go. And it's possible that Stephen Hawking himself may introduce the conference.
Oh, that would be absolutely wonderful. Will C-SPAN be covering it?
Not that I know of. I mean, I've received lots and lots of messages and PR representations about the conference, to no avail, and I would say that actually uniformly for the mainstream media. Pacifica and WBAI will be taping it and broadcasting the whole thing. But, you know, it's so hard to crack the mainstream media when all of our lives and our children's lives are on the brink of a nuclear extinction, and that actually happens to be a fact.
Will you be able to get on Democracy Now!, which I guess you would consider mainstream media, but...
Well, I know Amy, and in fact, it was me who turned Amy on when she was 18. She was taken by her father, who was a doctor, and her mother, who was a social worker, to hear me speak at St. Mary's Catholic Church on Long Island, and she was only 18, about the possibility of nuclear war, and that turned her on, and that created, in a way, it created Amy Goodman. She knows, and Democracy Now! Has definitely been alerted about this symposium, but there's been no response. So I just don't know how to crack the mainstream media. Do we wait until there's a nuclear war and people are lying, dying in the streets, burning to death and the like, thinking, oh my God, why didn't we start talking about this in the media and educating the people about what could happen, and then the people could rise up and prevent it, as we did in the 80s with the nuclear weapons freeze.
Speaking of the 80s, or even earlier than that, the 60s and the 50s during the Cold War, why is it that no prominent American scientists are speaking up the way that you're speaking up? I mean, I remember Bertrand Russell all the time being in the news, or Einstein or Oppenheimer being in the news. You know, there was a time when scientists and even great writers were considered superstars of the media. They don't seem to get a voice or attention anymore at all. But why isn't it that more American scientists who are prominent in our media aren't speaking up?
I don't know. I think they're practicing a form of psychic numbing. Now, it's very important to concentrate on global warming because that's a catastrophe. Will life end with a whimper or a bang? And global warming is the whimper, and nuclear war, which could occur tonight by accident, by heightened international tension, by mistake in a computer, by the Russians doing a crazy thing, or more likely the Americans doing a crazy thing, is being totally ignored. I think many of the scientists now are sort of emboldened to their people who give them grants and the like. A lot of them lack courage.
You know, it seems to me we're living in a world that's written, directed by Stanley Kubrick, Dr. Strangelove. The symposium that you did previously, talking about crisis to the end, I keep reading, whenever I can find it somewhere on the internet, about the monumental amounts of dangerous water being dumped into the Pacific Ocean. Is that true?
Yes.
And is it serious?
Every day since March 2011, over 400 tons of highly radioactive water have been dumped in the Pacific on a daily basis. It continues, but the water is becoming more and more and more radioactive as water pours down from the mountains behind the molten cores, three molten cores that melted their way probably into the earth. And the water washes over the cores and it becomes radioactive itself and then transports radioactive elements into the ocean. Now, the Pacific is a very, very large body of water, and therefore these elements become diluted. But the solution to pollution by dilution when it comes to radiation is fallacious, because the food chain reconcentrates cesium, strontium, tritium, and many other elements by orders of magnitude at each step. The algae, then the crustaceans, then the little fish, then the big fish, then us. And we stand highest on the food chain, and these elements concentrate most highly in human organs. You can't take, yeah?
Excuse me. Where do you live now for safety, and what do you eat?
I don't eat anything from Japan, not anything. Do not eat any Japanese food, rice, sushi, vegetables, miso, seaweed, nothing. In fact, there's an article today that I read that All Nippon Airways, ANA, are going to serve this month food coming from Fukushima. Can you believe that? And the food being grown in Fukushima, the rice is so radioactive they dilute it with non-radioactive rice. The fish are radioactive, and the vegetables and the spinach and the green tea, the whole thing, they're all radioactive.
The Japanese who fly those airlines will be glowing in the dark.
That's a saying, but of course that won't happen. And it takes like, 5 to 50 years or 80 years to develop your cancer once you've eaten some radioactive elements in food. And these elements concentrate in various organs like the brain and the liver and the heart and the thyroid and the bone, you name it.
You're in New York now for the symposium. You've lived in Boston and you've taught at Harvard. Where do you live now where you feel it's the safest?
Well, I live in Australia at the moment. I am but I also live here as a permanent resident. So I'm all the time in America giving lectures and the like. I'm not worried about my health now because I'm nearly 77. And as my daughter, who's a doctor, said, "Mum, don't worry. You won't live long enough to get your cancer now if you eat radioactive food," which always is very reassuring to me. I'm not worried about my own health. I'm worried about particularly the children who are 10 to 20 times more radiosensitive than adults, and little girls are twice as sensitive and more likely to get cancer when exposed to radiation than little boys.
Speaking of children, you started out as a pediatrician to heal and treat children, what was it about Three Mile Island that made you turn around?
It wasn't Three Mile Island. That's incorrect. That's somewhere on the web, but it wasn't Three Mile Island. What started me off was when I was about 17, I read a book called On the Beach by Neville Chute, from which that film was made. And the film was based in Melbourne, Australia, which was a city very far south. It was about a nuclear war that occurred by accident, and everyone in the world died except people in Australia. And it just demonstrates normal families waiting and waiting for death to come as the radiation and fallout comes down to Melbourne, and government dispensed cyanide capsules so that the people could give their babies cyanide so they'd die immediately and not a long, lingering, painful death, vomiting and bleeding to death. And at the end of that film, the beautiful, well, then Stanley Kramer made the film, the beautiful, elegant streets of Melbourne are still there with the trams in the streets, the libraries there, blinds gently flapping in the breeze, and that's the end of life on Earth. And that marked my soul. I was young, I was enthusiastic, I was excited about falling in love and becoming a doctor, but I was never the same again, and being of curious disposition, I read everything I could find on nuclear weapons. At the time when I did first-year medicine, I was only 17 then, I learned about genetics and radiation, and Muller, who won the Nobel Prize by irradiating Drosophila fruit fly, inducing mutations that were passed from generation to generation. At the time, Russia and America were testing bombs in the atmosphere, producing huge amounts of radioactive fallout in the Northern Hemisphere. I couldn't, for the life of me, understand what these wicked men thought they were doing. And I still feel exactly the same.
Helen, do you recall the first time you spoke out? And what kind of reaction did you get, first of all, from your family, especially your husband, because your children were probably extremely young. But those professionals who worked along with you, you were very, very successful as a pediatrician. Do you remember the occasion you first were compelled to speak out?
I first spoke out in 1971. When I found out the French were testing nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, violating the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty in the South Pacific. And in Adelaide, the city where I lived in South Australia, we got a high fallout. And someone leaked the measurements to me, and I became particularly concerned. And I remember speaking, the first time I ever spoke was to a group of women about this, and they were sitting in front row doing their knitting and stuff. But then I wrote a letter to the newspaper, the Advertiser, which is now owned by Rupert Murdoch, wasn't then, saying that children in Adelaide were at risk of getting leukemia or cancer from, you know, drinking radioactive milk and eating radioactive food, and they didn't publish the letter. So I rang the editor and said, "Where's my letter?" And he said, "Well, madam," condescendingly, "we get hundreds of letters a day." And I said, "Yes, but mine's important." I talked him into it. He published it. And that night I was on television. So every time, and I was, you know, very young. Every time
how
the French
old
tested,
were you? Do you recall?
I was about 30. Every
that's
time the French
young.
Tested another bomb, I was back on television. And in 9 months, Australians became so incensed with the French. They stopped buying French food, French wine. The mailman wouldn't deliver French mail. The Wharfies went on strike and wouldn't load French ships. And at the end of 9 months, 75% of Australians opposed those bloody French, they said, the bloody French. And we forced our Prime Minister and New Zealand to take France to the International Court of Justice. And they were forced to test underground. So I saw for the first time that an educated democracy behaves in a responsible fashion, and that's exactly what President Jefferson said. So I realized that as a doctor practicing global preventive medicine, one must educate the whole population, and the only way to do that is through the media.
Yes, but you were able to get on Australian television, and right now what you have to say and what you have to reveal is so much more important than what the French were doing. And this government had a little trouble with the French not too long ago, and they changed the name of French fries to Freedom Fries over something a lot pettier than the French testing nuclear bombs.
Yeah.
But why is it that you can't? I mean, it seems to me there may be a couple of shows. For example, HBO, which helped finance Citizen Four, does a show with a fellow that evidently has quite a large audience, a former comic named Bill Maher. It's called Real Time. I would think Bill Maher would just jump at the chance to have
well,
someone.
I've been on with Bill Maher in the past, but this time, well, you know, the PR messages went out to their producers. And you see, now a lot of people don't know me, but in the 80s I was all over television with Candy Bergen and Lily Tomlin and Sally Field. I had an agent in Hollywood called Pat Kingsley of P&K.
Oh, I remember Pat Kingsley.
Yeah. Well, she worked for me for free, and she got me in Vogue and Ladies' Home Journal and Life and Time, and she got me on television all over the place.
Been on Bill's show, why don't you just pick up the phone and call him personally?
Well, it's very hard to get through to these characters, as you know.
Well, listen, if it's Dr. Helen Caldicott and I want to be back on Bill's show, they have got to give him the message, I'm sure.
Oh, well, I mean, I was on Oprah Winfrey once. Rosie O'Donnell knew Oprah, and she got me on Oprah Winfrey, and it was just before America invaded Iraq. George Bush invaded Iraq, and I've just written a book called The New Nuclear Danger, exposing Cheney and Rumsfeld and all the rest of their wicked ways. So they filmed me for a half an hour in Hollywood, and they only used about 3 minutes of that clip, and it was in grey, not colour, and there was a man in a suit, a young man from one of the think tanks. And they used my quote, "I think we've never been closer to nuclear war." And the young man said to Oprah, "That's why we have to invade Iraq." And Oprah agreed with him. I was so incensed. I rang the producer.
Listen,
and the producer said,
you
were lucky to be on Oprah in the first place. I mean, how condescending and rude.
Oh, well, worse than that. You know, Phil Donahue had the most popular show on MSNBC. And he was fired because he had people on questioning Americans' foreign policy, especially Cheney and Bush, about their thoughts about going into Iraq and pointing out that there were only Arab passports found. There were no Iraqi passports found. And he was fired. The president of MSNBC told him point blank that he was not waving the flag enough. And I gave up. I thought Oprah in the beginning was one of the best interviewers in television until the Bush's lead up to the war in Iraq. One woman stood up in the audience because she had some guy from the CIA on. She had some guy with a military uniform with a medals that were weighing his shoulders down, talking about why we should go into Iraq. A young woman in her 30s stood up and said she had children. And she wanted some questions about why Iraq. And Oprah told her to sit down.
Yeah.
And
I was Phil Donahue's last guest on MSNBC talking about the possible Iraqi invasion. I was the last guest just before he was fired.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Well,
I know Phil well. He's a lovely man.
He is, and I have so much to ask you. So I'm gonna start with asking you about: will it be an accident that creates this devastation? Which, you know, as you look back over history, from the time we carved a knife, or we built a bow and arrow, or we built a spear, or we built a cannon, or we built a gun, we've used every weapon we've made, including the atom bomb, which we dropped in Hiroshima, and we didn't have to drop in Nagasaki, which we did to warn the Russians. But it seems to me inevitable that somehow this will happen. Will it happen?
Oh, I think it will, but there are many ways it could happen, and we will be addressing all those various ways. Now,
okay,
tell me
some of them.
Okay, so one of the reasons I set up this conference was I read an article in the Atlantic Monthly some months ago quoting Stephen Hawking and Max Tegmark talking about artificial intelligence and how within about 10 years the computers will be so autonomous and so intelligent that without human input they're really worried that the computers could start a nuclear war. And I thought, oh my God, I didn't know that. That's why I set the symposium up, and that issue is being addressed. Now, there are many other issues. We now have a very hawkish Senate with John McCain, who's never seen a war he didn't want to get into and kill people, who's the Armed Services Committee chairman. Terribly dangerous. Russia and America are confronting each other militarily for the first time since the Cold War ended. America orchestrated that coup in the Ukraine and put Poroshenko in, who is just an American puppet, like what's new, that always happens. Like Saddam Hussein was an American puppet. He worked for the CIA since he was 21. So it's all been orchestrated, and America's funded the Ukraine to the tune of $5 billion. And they're pushing Putin into a corner. Putin could be paranoid. You don't threaten a paranoid patient. They're likely to do something really dangerous. And he's got his weapons on a higher state of alert than normal. He's got over 1,000 H-bombs targeted on America and other countries. There are over 10 H-bombs, as I speak, targeted on New York City, 60 on Washington, D.C. And America's got the same in Russia. So who are the real terrorists in the world? The only terrorist.
Dr. Martin Luther King, 1 year before he was assassinated at the Riverside Church in New York, said to the standing room only crowd that the saddest thing that he had to report was that the largest terrorist organization in the world was the United States government and the American Pentagon,
That's
the American
correct.
Military. And a year later, they blew his brains out. And what a lot of people do not know is that the King family filed a civil suit against the FBI and the federal government. The jury awarded them an unreported sum of money, saying that the FBI was complicit in the murder of Martin Luther King. Helen, we have to take a brief break, and when I come back, I'm going to ask you about the nuclear construction contract that Barack Obama recently signed with the Indian government. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
I'd like to thank George Knapp, the best host on Coast to Coast, for that terrific unsolicited review of our documentary, The Last Word on the Assassination. You can get it at Amazon, as well as read dozens of other terrific unsolicited reviews, some from some very famous people. And also, while you're up there, for just a couple of bucks, you might want to pick up John Barber's Uncensored Facebook, Volume 1, with a terrific introduction by Richard Belzer. You can open it any place and find something that'll make you laugh or think it's sort of chicken soup for the funny bone. Helen, the question that I want to ask now is something that startled me, and I heard about it on the internet about a month ago, was that Obama has signed some kind of contract with the Indian government to build nuclear power plants. However, unlike Union Carbide 30 years ago, if there is a disaster, the Union Carbide disaster killed 25,000 Indians. But unlike that disaster, there would be no legal recourse to lawsuits. Have you heard about that?
Yes, that's exactly what he did, which is really obscene. Now, India has not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. India made its first nuclear weapon. It's got over 100, maybe 200, from a nuclear power plant that Canada sold it, and Canadian uranium. And so India wants to have nuclear reactors, and it's going to import uranium from Australia, my country, my uranium, to run its nuclear power plant so it can free up its own indigenous uranium to make more bombs. That's what it was all about. I can't believe Obama would have gone along with that, except that Exelon gave Obama $250,000 during his first campaign to get to be president. He's right within the nuclear powers industry's pocket weapons.
Helen, where does Israel fit into this business? I know that they resisted President Kennedy when he wanted inspections made of their nuclear facilities. And they resisted him when he tried to get AIPAC to register as a foreign lobby. And quite frankly, we're relieved when he was assassinated. There seems to be so much conflict in the Middle East, especially Israel's attitude toward Iran, who never invaded anybody. Where does Israel fit in to the possible nuclear holocaust?
Right. Israel has not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel has a huge number of weapons. I can't remember the exact number, but it's over 1,000, I think. It neither confirms nor denies that it has nuclear weapons, but it has, built from the Dimona reactor, which they said was to produce electricity, but it was really to produce bombs. So here's Israel, surrounded by enemy countries, or countries that don't like it, saying, we've got all the bombs, you can't have any. And what's more, if you do anything awful, we'll bomb you. That's wicked. That's really wicked. And then they're upset about Iran, who actually is performing according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which says that you're allowed to have nuclear power, you can have all the facilities that encourage nuclear power, like enrichment programs and the like, but you mustn't make bombs. So within the law, Iran is accurate, and your 16 intelligence agencies all say categorically there's no evidence that Iran is building a bomb. Now, Israel's making threatening noises. If Israel bombed the uranium reactor with a nuclear weapon, it could kill over a million people all the way over to Pakistan from the fallout. And I wouldn't put it past them. I mean, I felt that when Rabin was assassinated, that was the end. Rabin was a very wise man who was a general and was heading in the right direction for Israel. This Netanyahu, I mean, I hardly like to talk about him. He's crazy. And
well, John
many, there are many Israelis who are in the Peace Now movement, but they're just so dangerous and aggravating the tensions in that area. And it's a very highly nuclear-armed nation, and America funds Israel to the tune of $3 billion in weapons a year, and it funds Egypt to the tune of $3 billion in weapons a year.
Netanyahu is coming to Washington, D.C. to address the American Congress, uninvited by the president, as protocol calls for, invited by John Boehner. I mean, it gives us the impression that Obama doesn't run the country.
It does, and that's why Boehner decided to do it. That's obvious, and I think that I know Obama's furious and will not meet with Netanyahu, who doesn't like him anyway, because he can't talk to him or negotiate with him in any way. Netanyahu's dangerous to Israel. He's leading Israel down the wrong path.
The really good host on BBS Radio, a fellow named Rock, has a question he wishes to ask you. Rock, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks, John.
Please go
Hello,
ahead.
Helen. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
This is Rock Ash. I've been looking on Veterans Today website. I believe the Israelis have one of their Hispanic Patsy preachers stating that he's trying to warn the people that a asteroid might be hitting the southwest area of America, either Puerto Rico or Santa Dominica, and it's supposed to wipe out up to 35 to 40 million people. So the propaganda of a some type of natural happening going on is what they're trying to do, I guess, to put this nation into chaos here in the United States.
Yeah, well, you know, the best way to get people mobilized to do what you want is to make them frightened, and that's what they're doing, talking about terrorist stuff.
Right.
But the American people should be frightened about the fact that tonight they could all be annihilated with a nuclear war, and the bombs coming from Russia, they're very big. Robert McNamara, who is former Secretary of Defense under JFK, and I wrote an article for the LA Times describing the fact that there are at least 10 huge Russian hydrogen bombs targeted on New York as we speak, and no one is ignoring it. And I mean, no one is taking any notice. Everyone's practicing psychic numbing. It's a crazy...
Helen, what do you think has happened to some of the intellectuals in this country? I'm going to bring up a man, I have every one of his books, and I've admired him for years and years, and he's going to be one of the important speakers at your conference, talking about foreign policy. And there's probably no intellectual in America with the credentials that Noam Chomsky has. And he's going to be speaking, as I said, at your symposium. But two things about Noam Chomsky bother me severely. In the past 51 years, the two major catastrophes in this country related to our faulty foreign policy was the murder of John Kennedy in Dallas and, of course, 9/11. And I have seen Mr. Chomsky countless times being approached by students and scholars and asking him to elaborate on his intense disinterest and dismissing of questions from people about those two subjects. And it is beyond me how he can do that if he really is the intellectual he's supposed to be.
Well, I can't answer for Chomsky. But I, too, respect him enormously. And he's going to talk about a subject about which he is very familiar, the pathology within American politics, which allows the nuclear arms race to continue. The fact that Obama has just allocated $1 trillion over the next 30 years to rebuild every single nuclear weapon and delivery system, submarine, ship, plane, missile, you name it. It's absolutely crazy, and the people behind this are actually not just the neocons in the State Department. They're like, they're Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon, and the rest. And they were very upset when the Cold War ended, because then they couldn't make their weapons, so they had to conjure up new dangers so that they could keep going. And the Ukrainian situation, they're behind this, and this is absolute evil.
But these CEOs, Helen, they have families and they have children and they have grandchildren. Their grandchildren will become victims of their insanity. They have to see that.
Well, I've talked to some of them. I remember one man who was making cruise missiles, and I said to him, "But what about your children?" And he looked at me and he said, "I'm making money," with eyes like dead stones. And I said, "Yes. But what about your children's future?" And he said, "I'm making money." Now, I am a doctor, and I've treated many of these men on their deathbed or their children who are dying. And these men will fall into my arms when they're at the coalface of destiny and will admit all the wicked things they've done in their life. But it's too late. So what I'm saying is that I've delivered many babies, and they're born with this incredible purity of soul. And that's always implicit, innate, in every human soul. They know right from wrong, but they do it.
We have a call for you from your native land down under, Australia. Steve,
okay.
How are you? Welcome to the show. And Helen. Steve? Are you there? Helen?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, I guess we lost Steve. Have you ever had any prominent star from Hollywood or television or any prominent newscaster or any prominent politician come up to you privately and tell you how much they agree with what you're doing and how much they appreciate what you're doing?
Yeah, many, many. You know, Meryl Streep and lots of film stars all supported me. And Meryl hosted my film, 8 Minutes to Midnight, on Broadway. Politicians, Tip O'Neill, who was the Speaker of the House, who was from Cambridge, Massachusetts, he said the two most important things he's in his life were investigating the killing of the Mary Knoll nuns in Central America and getting the nuclear weapons freeze through Congress. I went to see Tip, and he came out from the House, chairing it, to his office, and he said, "Lovely, Tip." He said, "What can I do for you, Doctor?" And I said, Tip, I want you to play this film, The Last Epidemic, which was our medical symposium on the medical effects of nuclear war, in every single congressional office. And he did. He was a lovely man. But, you know, I met with Reagan for an hour and a quarter in the White House, alone, just with his daughter, Patty, and I ended up holding his hand for about half of that time because he really didn't know much at all. And I'd just written my book, Missile Envy, and I was full of facts and figures. And he'd get very anxious, and so I'd hold his hand and reassure him. So I kind of developed a doctor-patient relationship with him. I thought I'd had no impact at all upon the man. I judged his IQ to be about 100 average, and I came out saying I thought he had impending Alzheimer's from a clinical perspective, which he actually did.
Yes,
but after that, he started to say nuclear war must never be fought and can never be won, and he started working with Gorbachev. And together, those two men met over a weekend in Reykjavik in Iceland, and they almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons, because of the 16,400 weapons today in the world, Russia and America own 93%. So they're the only ones that threaten
and
the life on
the Earth. And the two of them brought down the wall, and we brought back Steve from Australia. I believe he's back on the line. Steve.
Yes, sir. Coming to you live and clear this time.
Okay, Steve. You have a question for Helen? We've got 4 minutes left.
Yes, sir. Ms. Helen, Dr. Caldicott, you're very, very famous in Australia. I'm calling from Western Australia. What we're seeing on the West Coast already is extinction-level events for certain species. What do you think it will take before people start to notice that we're losing species of animals already?
Well, Australia's a major exporter of coal. We're really, really implicit in global warming. We've got to stop digging up coal right now, and we've got to stop fracking because it adds methane to the atmosphere, which is a global warming gas. And we've got to rise up and take over our government. We've got a really, really bad government at the moment, as you know. And only citizen a process will change the attitude of our government, which is currently run by the corporations, as is the American government.
Helen, do you still know Meryl Streep?
Yeah.
Would she answer your phone if you called her?
Yeah, probably.
You call Meryl Streep. You tell Meryl that you want to get on Bill Maher's show once again to talk about your symposium.
All right, I'll give it a go tomorrow, or I might call Bill Maher's producer.
You please do that, because we need to hear you.
Yeah.
All of us need to hear you. And tell me again more about the symposium. Oh,
okay.
And tell me about On the Beach. I loved your story about On the Beach when you were talking on nuclear.
Yes, well, we're playing. What I've decided to play the film On the Beach because I know Karen and Kat Kramer, his wife and daughter, because that film turned me on. And you can talk about weapons till the cows come home, numbers, policies, and everyone stays in their left brain. I want people to feel it in their gut. And so I'm going to show all these scientists and doctors, etc., on the beach so that they really understand what it could mean that we exterminated life on Earth and the human species. I want them to really emotionally imbibe that film and understand it.
So how do people get to attend the symposium?
Okay, you go to HelenCaldicottFoundation.org and you can buy a ticket. It's only $60 for 2 days with two free lunches, which is cheap at half the price. And everyone from New York should go if they possibly can. And so you register at the website, and it's at the New York Academy of Medicine starting sharp at 9 o'clock. Kenneth Benedict from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists is moderating the first day. And Ray Atchison, she's from a very prominent New York anti-nuclear weapons organization, will moderate the second day. And we've got some really fantastic speakers, as well as this film.
Dr. Hilda Caldicott, I want to thank you so, so much for being here. I wish I could be there, but I must tell you, you are the sand in the world's oyster that creates the gem. You are indeed a pearl. And you're probably,
an irritant.
You are probably the sexiest 77-year-old I ever heard of.
You can't even see me, so you don't know what I look like.
I see you all the time because I look you up on the internet and I read you and watch you whenever I can. And again, thank you so, so much for being here.
Oh, and thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. Again, okay. If there's anything you would like to say in saying goodbye, please say it to your audience.
Yes. Okay, so you can all live stream the symposium. Please, this is the most important issue facing the Earth at this time. Will we destroy the creation? And I once asked Carl Sagan if he thought there was any other life in the universe. He paused and said no, and I said, why? He said, because if any species had reached our stage of evolution, they would have destroyed themselves. Are we going to stand by and let ourselves destroy ourselves and all other species? Or will we rise up and become Joan and John of Arc and save this planet? That's what we must do.
Well, you've sort of turned into the intellectual Joan of Arc. And the admiration that people must have for you. What does your husband and what do your children think of what you're doing now?
Well, I don't have a husband. He left me 20 years ago. But
why?
My children, I mean, my children were very upset because I wasn't around a lot in their adolescence. But now they're very proud of me. And my daughter's a doctor who's an integrated medical physician who's an absolute pioneer in her own right. And she's wonderful. And my other son, he's in Boston. In fact, I'm in his house now, and he cleans up toxic waste. My other son owns a restaurant, and he's a wine specialist, and he just loves nurturing and looking after people. But they all totally agree with me, and I think in the end they're proud, although they've never read any of my books.
Oh, that's wonderful. Dr. Hildicott, again, thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend out there.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye, dear.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny.